you all for coming. I really appreciate it. This next one. So I was having almost second thoughts today about whether I should treat the Maharshal as a separate section or not, because one could very much argue that he kind of, to a certain extent or from a certain perspective, pales in comparison to some of his other contemporaries. But that's only in terms of history. In terms of his contemporary position, he was a force to be reckoned with in Ashkenaz Jewry. In Polish Jewry, the Maharshal was a tour de force. He was a powerful personality, and someone who, because of the nature of the Svarim that he wrote, so hasn't really taken off in terms of what we think of him, or we don't really notice him that much. Because, and again, you'll see why he didn't write them. The Rama, Rav Moshe Itzerlis, who we spoke about last week, the Rama was very much a well-respected and accepted figure, and a lot of it had to do with the text that he wrote. He wrote a layman's text. Because he wrote a layman's text, so laymen are the ones who carry tradition from one generation to the next. So we all know the Rama or the Mapa, as we call him. You know, we all know that one singular person who is the Ashkenazic losses on the Shulchan Aruch. However, we don't know of the Maharshal, and it's very important. I think you get a major glimpse into the Maharshal's personality in one particular tshuva that he wrote. The Maharshal wrote two books that we know of. Number one is a book called The Yam Shel Shlomo. The Yam Shel Shlomo is a straight-out interpretive commentary on Shas. It is very much not a layman's book. It was not written for lay people. It was written for scholars. It was unique and innovative interpretations, and they are known. The Yam Shel Shlomo is known for its boldness in terms of its chiddush, in terms of its innovative perspective. And he also wrote Shelot U'Tshuvot. He also wrote a book of responsa, which he was one of the first people to realize that just because someone doesn't write you a letter doesn't mean you don't have to take a position on it. So the assumption of some is that some of his responsa were his own questions rather than actually having received things, because, like I said, there's a limited amount of, you know, you can only be so creative in terms of what type of svarim that you write. You know, as we go on, should we continue, this may be a year down the road, but if we ever get to Rav Yerucham Fishel Perlau, so he took a poem that Rav Saadia Gaon wrote on the 613 mitzvot that was basically one page long and turned it into a three-volume book of commentary on it. So it's hard to be creative a lot of times in terms of what you're producing. So here the Maharshal has a fascinating question. So just so you know, the Maharshal was either a first or second cousin to Rav Moshe Itzerlis, and probably no person was more critical of the Rama than the Maharshal. We saw last week he was the Maharshal, Rav Shlomo Luria, was the one who attacked the Rama on his study of the Mor Nevuchim, of the Guide to Perplexed, and his knowledge of Aristotle and his use of the Mor Nevuchim in some of his texts. In this week, we're going to get to his criticisms of the Shulchan Aruch, which he was harsh in them and very public in his criticisms of them. But before that, you'll see very much his perspective on life just from this one tshuva. So it's here, it's a lot of Hebrew, it's a very long tshuva, and I cut out about three paragraphs of it. But it's a very accessible tshuva. You know, a lot of responsa are difficult to read. But this one is very accessible as far as tshuva go. So he says, She'ila, the question. Yorenu Morenu, let our teacher teach us, Seder Hayachas Bein HaGaonim HaMechabrim Tzvarim. He says, can you please tell us the relationships between all the history of authorship. Why would anyone write a question like this? Can you please just tell us the entire history of the authorship of Torah, going back all the way to the Gaonim? So he answers, Tshuva, let me answer you. Seder Yachat in the Kabbalah Mufletet. He says, I don't have a clear or concise Kabbalah or tradition on it. Ella kol adam hakori b'sifrei poskim mitoch hahergel shedivreim u'machlokatam al yidei ma'asim. He says, but anyone who reads through books and works, u'machlokatam and their arguments, al yidei ma'asim, yakir k'tash seder toldatam. Anyone who sits and learns in the Beis Medrash, you know the history, or you know some of the history. Achen atik l'cha ma'ashem atati u'itak. He says, therefore, based on his very broad knowledge, he's going to tell you basically all of history. And now, basically, what you have is a timeline. And just to give you a little bit of an example. Rav Hai kibel Torah me'Rav Shira Gaon. Rav Hai Gaon, who is the first of the Gaonic period, this is important also because it's going to, you'll see. I don't want to give away so much of it. But so he says, Rav Hai Gaon, who is 9th century CE, Kibel Torah me'Rav Shira Gaon, he got it from Rav Shira Gaon. V'samchu l'Gaono b'netim shana shnat dalet al afim, v'tavshin lamin vav l'bria. So Rav Hai Gaon gets the tradition, or takes the mantle of leadership from Rav Shira Gaon when he's just 20 years old. And this is in the year 4000, tavshin lamin vav, so tav is 400, shin is 736, so it's 4736. Yeah, 4736. Lebria, right? Misham ve'ilach pasku ha-gaonim ve'rabinu gershom memhe kibel mirav hai v'niftar shnat alef rafim v'taf-taf. So what happens? In 4600, Rabbeinu Gershom, or thereabouts, Rabbeinu Gershom takes over, and the tradition has it, Ashkenazic tradition has it, that Rabbeinu Gershom, he accepted the Torah, or he accepted tradition from Rav Hai Gaon. Rabbeinu Gershom then dies on the day Rashi is born. That is the tradition. Why is this very important to tradition? So first of all, who was Rabbeinu Gershom? Rabbeinu Gershom was known in Ashkenazic communities in Western Europe as Me'or Hagola, as the light of the exile. Why? Because he basically created a traditional structure and a halachic structure for Ashkenazic Jewry. Rabbeinu Gershom is living in the area that we now call Germany. His students were the teachers of Rashi, and tradition has it that basically God never leaves his children as orphans without a leader, and so it can't be that Rabbeinu Gershom dies without the new leader being born. So who's the new leader born right after Rabbeinu Gershom?
Rashi.
Okay? What happens? End of the 11th century, 1096 to be exact, German Jewry is basically severely, severely damaged. By what? Crusade number one. Sure enough, thank God Rashi has all the traditions of German Jewry, and he is living where? Troyes, in France. Okay? And so Rashi picks up the mantle of leadership. And then he goes on. Rashi transfers the leadership to not his daughters, because it was the Middle Ages after all, and that would have been
a no-no.
So who does Rashi transfer the leadership in? The only one of Rashi's grandchildren to actually have learned with him, or that we know for a fact that he learned with him, Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir Rashbam. Rashi actually has two grandchildren, or more than that. He has more than two grandchildren, but two fairly famous grandchildren, right? Rashbam, Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir, and Rashbam's much younger brother, Rabbeinu Tam, who's also, his name was Yaakov, right? Yaakov Ish Tam Yoshevu Alim, and so he got the name Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam ruled with an iron hand. What does that mean, he ruled with an iron hand? You can see some of his Shelot U'Tshuvot. We spoke about it a little bit last week. But Rabbeinu Tam in his Shelot U'Tshuvot, so his famous line was that a certain community was not holding of the traditional Psak Halacha that he took as a position. And he wrote to them a letter that said cease and desist. And they said, this is our tradition, and Rabbeinu Tam famously wrote back, Minhag is backwards Gehenim, and basically, stop, your tradition is over. I define tradition. Okay, that was Rabbeinu Tam's line. Rabbeinu Tam transfers it over to others, and he goes through the whole list all the way down, all the way up. Who do you think the last person on the list is? Rabbi Shlomo Luria. Okay? He is the last person, the last individual on the list. Why is he the last individual on the list? Because he can trace his lineage all the way back, he says, all the way back to Rashi himself. I am descendant of Rashi. That's what he says. Of leadership in this area. That's what he says. And so, what's really interesting, though, is at the end, of the responsa, where he's talking about a piyut, if you ever look in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur davening, so we have all those little things that are often written in acrostic, that no one understands, that they just insert randomly into various different tfilos that make our davening much longer. So in Israel, most people don't say all those things, but it's America, so we have to say everything. So one of the ones we actually don't say, which is the longest sourced one of the oldest piyutim that we know. It's a piyut called Emat Nora Techa, which is actually in the back of all the art scroll machzorim, but I've yet to see a shul that says it. If you look in the kolbo, it's actually in the kolbo. It's in the kolbo puts it in, but like I said, it's not in the art scroll, so therefore we don't say it, because they decide what we say. At the end here, he says, listen, the end. Who was it that wrote Emat Nora Techa? So here I bolded it right at the end. It's on page 2. Rabbeinu Moshe Hazaken. Who asher yasad et Emat Nora Techa? Okay? Who was the one who wrote Emat Nora Techa, this incredibly, he's saying, in the 16th century, this incredibly old, piyut, poem that we say as part of our davening, who wrote it? Rabbeinu Moshe. Okay. Who's Rabbi Moshe HaZaken? So he says, who Rabbi Moshe HaZaken ben Rabbi Klonimus ben Rabbeinu Yekutiel Ben Rabna Meshulam, Ben Rabni Itel, Ben Ramna Meshulam Tchuto Leolam Vaed. Okay? So this is the very same Rabbi Moshe, who is the son of Rabbi Klonimus, who is the son of Rabbi Yekutiel, who is the son of Rabbeinu Moshe Ben Rabna Meshulam, Ben Rabna Itel, Ben Ram Meshulam. Okay? And who is this Rabbi Moshe HaZaken? Why is he so important? Rabbeinu Moshe HaZaken, who is this? Heviu HaMelech Karla Imo Mimidinat Luka Bishnaf Taf Taf Mem Teh. So, who is this Rabbeinu Moshe HaZaken? He is the one who was brought by the King Karla. Does anyone know who the King Karla is?
Polish king?
Charlemagne. Remember, we're in Western Europe. We're not in Poland yet. Charlemagne brought him in Taf Taf Mem Teh. What year is that?
866.
Okay? What? Yeah, well, Taf Taf Mem Teh is
849.
What?
849.
Okay, 849. Okay, so somewhere around the 10th century. Okay? Okay? And he says, the Chorban Beit HaMikdash, Yiban Beit HaMikdash, Mehera B'Yameinu Amen. So it's 869 years, he said, 849 years after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash.
It's 4,800.
Right, so that is somewhere in the 10th century, right? So what's he talking about? So here he's touching on a very, very strong Ashkenazic tradition and Ashkenazic pride. The way it goes is as follows. Okay, it's recorded in numerous books, and Marshall is still recording it here. He says that way back in the 10th century, there weren't very many Jews living in Western Europe, particularly in the Rhineland, where Charlemagne is king. And Charlemagne complains, why don't I have any Jews who want to live by me? That's what Charlemagne complains about. Where are my Jews? How come everyone else has Jews? So people say, well, life for the Jews, they go where it's comfortable. Where was life comfortable for the Jewish people? In Italy. So Charlemagne says, well, what makes it comfortable there? Well, Jews, they say, respect. Who do they respect? Their rabbis, their teachers, their educators. So he says, if you bring teachers and educators and rabbis here, then the Jews will come also. Why is Charlemagne interested in Jews?
Money.
Jews lend money, right? That's what, you know, money makes money. You need money lenders. Usury is prohibited by the church. So money makes money. So what does Charlemagne do? He goes over, he goes all the way to Italy, because that's where the Jews live. Why are the Jews living in Italy, according to this tradition? Jews are living in Italy because... because Rome destroyed... destroyed the Beit HaMikdash, right? And the Jews were exiled to Rome. They were taken there as slaves. They built their communities in Rome. You know, Italy has one of the oldest Jewish communities. So Charlemagne goes there, and he asks who are the biggest scholars, and they tell them that all the scholars are from the Colonimus family. Okay? Colonimus, a nice Italian-sounding name. So he has to convince one of the Colonimides, as they're known in some of the literature, to come with him back to Mainz, to the Rhineland. So he convinced Rabbi Moshe HaZaken, then Rabbi Clonimus, to come with him all the way back to Ashkenaz, to the Rhineland. And sure enough, Rabbi Moshe ben Rabbi Clonimus agrees. Okay? And he goes back. And that's how basically those were the beginnings of Ashkenaz community. This was lore amongst Ashkenaz. You know, this was who they were. Why is this such a sense of pride? We are descendant of the exiles from Jerusalem, you know, the last holdouts of exiles in Jerusalem. We were taken as slaves to Rome, to Italy, and we were brought ultimately to Ashkenaz, and this is where we established, and that was the sense of pride that they had in their community. So when the Maharshal says he's descendant of Rashi, he's not just whistling Dixie, he's saying that this is a meaningful moment. I am bound up in the nobility and in the pride of what Ashkenaz is. What do you mean? They had what scholars would call the Palestinian tradition. The Sephardim, they were taken east. They didn't come back with Ezra and Nehemiah and build Beit Sheni. They're already Beit Rishon people. We are Second Temple people. We are, you know, descendants of the Pharisees. You know, this is who we are. You know, the Sephardim, they're North African. The community in Alexandria was existent concurrent to the community in Israel. So, you know, it's...
The Romans weren't really true Sephardim.
Well, they were Palestinians. They weren't Palestinians. They were Israelis. They were Israelis.
Palestine.
What only became Palestine after they got kicked out, right? There's a lot of debate over to whether this story is true. But the truth is, I'm not really worried as to what the real origins of Ashkenazic Jewry are. Because for understanding the Maharshal, it doesn't matter whether he was really descendant from the great Roman sages of you know, 500 or 600 years in the past. What's important is that he and everyone else believed that they were descendants of all these great Roman sages, etc. And what is the Rama doing? You have this entire Ashkenaz community that feels immensely threatened. They feel immensely threatened, why? Because they've been moved out of the Rhineland. They've been moved to Poland. They're really establishing communities. Their notion and their pride of what it was to be, what it was to be an Ashkenazic Jew, is shaken to the core. Okay? They're rebuilding their communities, communities which are immensely useful. Right? You don't have, you know, we think of Krakow and Warsaw and the surrounding shtetls. What are older communities than those? Whereas, you know, to the Ashkenazic Jew in the 1500s, Krakow and Warsaw were comparable to the Five Towns in Scarsdale. You know, basically, you know, all right, you've been living here for 50 years, maybe you have a few restaurants, it's good living, but you don't have the tradition of a Krakow, right? So now in Krakow, you don't have a tradition of a Magenta, of a Worms. You don't have that type of tradition. And what's the Rama doing? The Rama is invoking authority as if he has a power over that area, and this the Maharshal feels like cuts to the core of what it means to be an Ashkenazic Jew. On the one hand, the Rama is very deferential to this Ashkenazic tradition. Why is he deferential to this Ashkenazic tradition? He's deferential to this Ashkenazic tradition because what is he doing? He says, I'm here to defend the honor of the Tosafists. I'm here to remind everyone that we have always been, committed to the statements of the Tosafists. You know, so I'm going to be quoting, you know, the Mordechais and the Rushes and the Tzmags and the Smaks and the Rabbeinu Tams and all those other things that the Rav Yosef Karo is not quoting. I'm going to stand this up, and the Maharshal, something is running counter to his sense of belief. Something is running counter, and here he creates what is perhaps one of the most eloquent and strongest attacks on the Shulchan Aruch. Okay? And what are his attacks? He says, number one, no code is self-sufficient. Okay, I put it, there are four attacks. What does that mean, no code is self-sufficient? You can't just decide that your text is the primary text by which all other texts are going to be judged. It just doesn't work like that. You can't just decide, well, because I'm the one who gathered everything together, so therefore I'm the authoritative text. Where did you get this authority? How can I trust what you say in this text without the Talmud, without the various interpreters? You're choosing Rabbeinu Tam. You're choosing, you know, the Rush. You're choosing the Mordechai. You can't have a text that is internal, that is self-sufficient in that sense. Number two, rabbinic independence is ideal. This is something we spoke about a little bit last week. But the Maharshal says as follows. What makes the Tosafists the Tosafists? Complete independence. There's a wonderful line in Rashbam. So Rashbam, his commentary on Chumash, is different than Rashi. He basically offers answers to Rashi's questions, not based on quoting a midrash, not based on quoting some sort of rabbinic text to answer the question. But instead, he'll focus on his own kind of simple meaning or interpretation. Just to give you an example, we'll take Parsha Vayikra. Rashi implies the question of why start Vayikra as opposed to anything else. Okay, why all of a sudden start Vayikra when we're usually starting Vayidaber Hashem El Moshe Limor? So Rashi says, God calls to Moshe all the time. And he quotes the Midrash, L'chola dibrotu l'chola amirot kadma kriya. Every time God spoke to Moshe, he called him first. Why? Because kriya is a statement of love, right? The malachim, the angels, when they speak to one another, they say v'kara zeh el zeh v'yamar. Each one calls out to each other. It's a statement of love. It's a statement of respect. Rashbam says, I got an answer. What happened at the beginning what, at the end of Parshat Shemot, they finished building the Mishkan. All of a sudden, Moshe has an office. He doesn't know how to use the office. So what does God have to do? Vayikra el Moshe. Moshe, come here. We talk here now. I don't talk to you anywhere. Now we talk in the Holy of Holies, in the Tent of Meeting. That's where we meet now. Okay? So it's a very practical interpretation that, to a certain extent, ignores rabbinic interpretation. Okay? Rashbam is extraordinarily bold, to the point where he says things like the simple interpretation of Ukshartam la'ota yadecha, that you shall tie them onto your arm. Rashbam says, it's symbolic, it's metaphorical. The Rashbam can do these things because he's one of the Tosafists, and, you know, no one questions his halachic, you know, kind of authority. But what's interesting, Rashbam says, he starts to tell a little story in the midst of his interpretation. He says that when he finished writing his interpretation of Chumash, he showed it to Rashi. What happened when he showed it to Rashi? Rashi said, this is great. This is wonderful. This is stupendous. I love it. You know, if I could do it all over again, I would write something just like you did. Didn't he just write something that takes an entirely different position than Rashi? Could you imagine? Could you imagine today? If, you know, you have the Gadol Hador, right, who basically takes a perspective on reading Chumash, and then his grandson stands up there and says, write the whole book on why my grandfather was mistaken. Okay? Okay, and then grandfather says, you know, got a good point. Maybe if I were a younger guy, I would write something more like it. It's wild. But Rashi created a tradition of creativity, which on the one hand had an immense respect for the past, so much respect that the greatest respect you could give them was taking the time to prove them wrong. Which is why, Tosafists, they spend a good portion of their time questioning how Rashi missed this, and why wasn't he worrying about that? And granted, who knows if Rashi had Rashi, if he would have written Tosafos, but he didn't. But the point was, is it seems like Rashi was very much encouraging rabbinic independence. And so the Maharshal is saying, rabbinic independence is one of our ideals as an Ashkenazi community. We believe in the power of the posek of that generation to decide what is appropriate for that generation. This is part of our ideal. This is part of what we believe in. The posek has the right to decide for his generation. He doesn't have, you know, a blank check. He has, you know, he's committed to sources. But that being said, the posek has that right. Number three, he says, is the Talmud reigns supreme over everything. He says he doesn't like the Ramaz line that I have a fealty to the Tosafists. The Maharshal says we have fealty to two books. Book number one that we have fealty to is the Torah, right, the written word of God. Book number two that we have fealty to is the Talmud, okay, the interpreted word of God. That is it. That is it. No other text has the right to be binding. The Talmud is binding, and the Talmud is filled with argumentation and interpretation, and that is the only thing that binds us. Which means that it is ultimately scholarship that binds us, interpretation that binds us. You cannot decide that you, what are you saying essentially? By me taking a position on halacha, that this is what it is for all of Jewry and for time immemorial, I've created greater authority for my own text than I have for the Talmud. Rama, you may be great and wonderful and stupendous, but Rav Ashi and Ravina, you are not. You are not an Amora. You are not a Tana. So how can you create authority out of that? And that leads into number four. There is no authority to post-Talmudic generation. Anything we say is merely commentary. If you say something or I say something, it is no more binding on me than anything else. And that's why the Maharshal felt that it was the right and responsibility of the posek of every generation when he came up with something for which there was no normative psak, he has to rediscover America. Okay? Rav Soloveitchik used to do this, which is, you know, whenever he would teach a Masechet again, so he would deal with the same questions again and again, and someone would say, well, last year Rebbe said what? And he would always say, never mind what I said last year. Right? The Marshal says it is the job of the religious and halachic leader in every generation to rediscover. So if I, the Marshal says, if I am confronted with a halachic issue of contemporary import, just because Rabbeinu Tam took a position, that is not binding upon me. That does not make me all of a sudden, you know, unable to think freely. That is not the nature of the experience of the posuk. I have total rights. I have total freedom. I go back to the Talmudic text. I go back to its interpretation. I offer my own interpretations. I make my own inferences. I come to my own conclusion, and I defend that conclusion. Okay? And I defend it for my community. I think independence is ideal, right? That the posek needs to have the right to total independence. Number three, the Talmud reigns supreme. The Talmud is ultimately the final arbiter of all halachic discussion. And you can't say, he says, number four, no authority to post-Talmudic generations. You can't allow post-Talmudic generations to have comparable authority to that of the Talmud and the Mishnah. It just doesn't work. And so the truth is, what's interesting, is that these two perspectives have really been kind of concurrent perspectives throughout Jewish history. If you look in more recent times, you take the Mishnah Berurah, who's very much into the traditional Psak Halacha. You know, what are they saying? You know, what are the majority, I wouldn't even say majority, but what is the more dominant opinion amongst the Achronim? Whereas you take someone like Rav Moshe Feinstein, who really did very often, you know, we don't think about it because he's automatically associated with the traditionalists, but in terms of his path of Psak, he was very much a creator, he was very much an innovator in the way he dealt with Psak. Rav Moshe would go about rediscovering America. You'll see someone like the Aruch HaShulchan, who we'll get to, Rav Yechiel Michel Epstein. Also someone interested in being an innovator in rediscovering America and kind of looking at things from that perspective. So even though the Maharshal, in terms of when we think about Jewish history, we don't often think of him as a major player because, again, he had the bad luck of not writing the right Sefer. But to a certain extent, I feel like he probably would have been proud of the fact that, you know, he wanted you to go back and look at the Gemara and to see it. You know, don't feel bound, you know, here in the 21st century by the fact that some guy named Luria wrote something. You should go back, you know, go see your Gemaras, go see your Rishonim, and come to the conclusion all on your own. That's the perspective that the Marshal was promoting. And again, this creates kind of two trends throughout Jewish history that go on. You have, you know, trend number one of the more kind of we are bound by the traditionalist experience, and trend number two of the posek who is the creator, the innovator, and the one who takes nothing for granted and leaves no stone unturned and can't say, well, just because he said something doesn't mean I'm going to say something.
What you're not saying, basically, is that there is no such thing as indisputable halacha.
The Maharshal is saying that there is such a thing as disputable halacha. There's no such thing as indisputable halacha. Anyone who takes a position after the Talmud is basically up for grabs and needs to stand there and defend himself against future interpreters.
Just a comment. If you look at the fourth item, no authority, it basically includes all the others.
Yeah.
Because it's just, since there's no authority, nothing can be final, nothing can be done, we need independence. It's something that it says in the Torah, Ovata al-Shafet Asher Yeh Bayamim Ahem. And the interpretation precisely is that the psak din must be made by shofet shiyeh bayamim ahem, by the judge of those days, meaning basically what...
Listen, everyone can have an affinity to one interpretation over another, but in the end of the day, it's an affinity, and that's something you have to realize.
But I'm saying the Torah itself says, if you have a problem, go to the judge or you...
Right, but the question here is, should you go to the judge or shouldn't you go to the judge? The question is, what's the judge going to do? Is he going to open up and say, well, the Ramah has taken this position, and that's the position I'm taking because the Ramah is authoritative? Or is he going to say, well, give me 2 days, I'm going to go look this up in all the Gemaras and come to the conclusion?
Second choice.
So it doesn't always happen like that. It's two strains within Judaism, and I think I would argue that every generation needs to, you know, the deciders of that generation need to take the positions that fit their generation's best. Avi, yeah. So I don't know if anyone ever spoke in those grandiose terms, but I believe they were looking to create the authoritative text of the future. It's just for sure of Yosef Karo, because of, there's all this eschatological, you know, messianic fervor going on, and the notion of consolidation was probably very exciting. Of, you know, of a unified experience and practice of the Jewish people. I think that's probably very exciting.
So the thing is that somebody who opposes the Gadol HaDor is going to disagree with what the Rama or what the Yosef Karo said. Doesn't he have this guilt complex that he's going against the greatest?
So one of the things you'll be interested in is the first generation of commentators on the Shulchan Aruch, the Sma, the Bach, people like that, are much bolder in the things they'll say about Psak Halacha than later generations. And I think a lot of it, what? We've lost the guts, or the nature of tradition is that it solidifies itself over time. It's just the nature of the beast.
It becomes
I mean, listen, you could call it what, you know what I mean? You could call it stultified, you could call it frozen, or you could, it's all a matter of terminology of how you use it. Or I can say it's become foundational. I can say, you know, call it what you want. But if you call it stultified or frozen or backwards or whatever, and I call it foundational and supportive, and you know, we mean the same thing, but you know what I mean, what you call something, you know, yeah. Yeah, and listen, what can you ask for in an immigrant community? What are they looking for any more than consistency? You know, that, yeah.
Is this, I guess, a dichotomy effective, the fact that the Torah and the Talmud don't have vowels?
No, I mean, it's affected only because it lends itself to ambiguity, but I, you know, that's just a fact of history.
The Rama and the Shulchan Aruch must agree on many points.
Well, yeah.
Many points.
Well, one thing you'll notice about one of the beauties of our religious experience is that you can walk into any Orthodox shul in the world, and the Torah look the same. you know, the words on the Torah look the same. You know, they'll be saying basically the same word, you know, a little bit of a different pronunciation, but things are basically the same way. The problem is the closer you are together, is the more your differences become highlighted. You know what I mean? Rav Amital always used to have a line, you know, his cousin was Rav Shach, who was head of the Haredi, you know, the far right of Orthodox Judaism. And they used to get together on Sukkot. There was always a big family get-together. And so one of his students once asked me, he said, do you ever argue? He said, sometimes two people are so far apart, it's really not worth arguing anymore. So he said, the only reason that, you know, machloket is created out of a closeness and out of an intimacy that very much exists there. So the Rama and the Shulchan Aruch agree a good portion of the time. In fact, yeah, like I said, the assumption is that any time the Rama doesn't say anything, it means he agrees that what the Shulchan Aruch says is right. And what I will tell you is this, is as bold as, let's say, Rav Moshe was, or the Aruch HaShulchan was in history, they always gave deference to the Rama and Rav Yosef Karo, never the same deference to the Marshal. But there are certain positions in halacha that earn deferential treatment. I was actually reading recently, Rav Nassim Kamenetsky, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky's son, said that claims, I've never checked if it's true or not, but that Rav Moshe gave complete deference to the Chai Adam, to Rav Avram Dantzig, more than anyone else. Which, when we get to Chai Adam, we'll get to him. But because for Lithuanian Jewry, he was, you know, the heir of the Rama on a lot of issues. But certain people gain deferential treatment over their careers, and you know, sometimes generations wash that deference away, and sometimes it doesn't. And nothing has washed away the deference to the Rama or to the Shulchan Aruch.
Just a general comment. The problem that we are having with halacha was created because our rabbi decided that every step in your life is controlled by the religion. If they hadn't made that decision, we would have no problem.
Correct. We also might not have a religion, but you know what I mean? Okay.
A different religion. I'm not saying we might not have a religion.
Right.
Christianity, Alhamdulillah, is more general and so forth and so on.
And also, Rav Soloveitchik pointed this out once also. He says, people complain about the inflexibility of halacha also. He said, the more flexible we are, the less likely we are to transfer it down to the next generation. Once you allow for too much subjectivity, you basically have allowed everyone to create their own religion to the point where you'll have 20 different religions.
That's probably a attempt was made in the year zero or whatever.
Listen, Anshei Knesset HaGdola, I mean, you know what I mean? It's like people say about Rashi in terms of there are certain individuals or groups of individuals who have a foresight that we cannot imagine. You know, Rashi, the Rambam, and Anshei Knesset HaGdola, you know, were inspired by a Ruach HaKodesh that, you know, the world has never known. And they made strong decisions, some of which, you know, we feel are, you know, frozen in pre-medieval history, you know, but to a certain extent, what choice do we have if they've been, you know, if they've been so solid in terms of their predictive capacity? So sometimes we can defend it. Sometimes we can't, but that doesn't mean, you know, you throw out your religion just because you can't defend one of their decisions. Yes, ma'am. Wait till next week. Next week we start the Kabbalists and Svat. Next week we start a two-part series. I call it Mystics and Magic Makers. We're gonna start first with the Kabbalists of Svat. We'll do an introduction to what we call Lurianic Kabbalah. Then we'll move over to Poland. We'll move over to Eastern Europe, and we'll do the Maharal of Prague. And we'll do some of what?
That's part of the magic.
Well, if you had to come 2 years ago Shavuot night when I proved to everyone that the Golem never happened, but. He was a mystic, and
I saw the picture.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I saw.